Hello and welcome. Constitution Day is September 17th, and as part of our educational efforts here at IPFW, we are lucky enough to have a speaker with us, Georgia Rahlstedt Olmschneider. She is a graduate of Washington University, 1978, when she earned her JD. Her teaching and research interests include civil liberties and constitutional law in general. She will be giving us a talk today called The Supreme Court, The Politics of Interpretation, but I have to put in a brief plug for her beforehand. This spring, she'll be teaching a class called National Security and the Constitution, so make sure that you register for that. But until then, she can give you a little bit of flavor with today's talk of the Supreme Court and the politics of interpretation. Georgia.
Thank you, Andy. Normally, I might sit on a desk or something in a classroom, but obviously for the television audience and for a lecture of a little bit more, I'm trying to look a little more formal, if you will. So when Andy asked me to do this, and I was thinking about the title of the talk called The Supreme Court and the Politics of Interpretation, I was trying to think of an event, a moment in recent time that would sum up what the politics of interpretation is now in kind of modern American history. And the event that came to mind right away was Justice Gorsuch's recent confirmation hearings. It highlighted the kind of modern idea of the politics of constitutional interpretation. And I was ready to say that until I looked today, of course, on the ubiquitous kind of Google and the news. And there was something on a blog that I get on Fine Law that had to do with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was recently at a conference called The American Dream Reconsidered, and she spent a good deal of her lecture basically telling Congress to stop the nonsense in only Ruth Bader Ginsburg could do, her way of doing it. And what she meant by that was that she was upset that all the confirmation hearings in terms of the vote and then the vote on the floor of the Senate are completely partisan. And she pointed out that even when her dear friend Anton Scalia had his confirmation hearing and then went to a vote on the floor, that it was, if not unanimous, almost unanimous. And that was troubling her because she's concerned about the idea of judicial independence. So what I want to talk about a little today is this modern politics of interpretation, and suggest that it's a little more nuanced even than it first appears. Even thinking about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I would suggest that there's more to it than even appears in her stop the nonsense comment. So here we go. The reason I said Justice Gorsuch's recent confirmation hearings is if you watched it all or you read anything or you looked at the newspaper, you know that he was repeatedly asked by both Republican and Democratic senators, liberals and conservatives, however that term of art is, about his approach to constitutional interpretation. Is it like Scalia or different than Scalia? If it's like Scalia, how's it like Scalia? Or is it, if it's different than Scalia, how's it different? And he was asked many, many, many times. Now, the reason is, of course, is that the senators are very aware that, of course, the Constitution's a political document in so many ways. You know, it was written during the period of political struggles in the time of our founding. It maps out the nation's fundamental political arrangements, powers, structures, limits of government. Senators are aware that decisions aren't made in a political vacuum. And as Alexis de Tocqueville said many years ago, most political questions become legal ones, in this case, constitutional ones. So obviously, the interpretation of the Constitution matters. Now, here's the difference. Here's the difference. And this is what, in a way, Justice Ginsburg was talking about and why I'm talking about the politics of modern constitutional interpretation. The difference is from the 19th century until the 80s, for the most part, the controversies over the Constitution and its meaning in our polity were framed in terms of not approaches and theories of constitutional interpretation, but they were debated upon in terms of different political visions. What's the role of the court? What's the meaning of federalism? What's the meaning of separation of powers? And when, for a long time, justices didn't even sit before the judiciary panel and take questions about constitutional interpretation, etc. But when they did, starting in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, then you're starting to see a little shift. By and large, they were asked about their qualifications, not so much about their approaches or theories of constitutional interpretation. I'm not suggesting there were never any questions, but it wasn't the vast bulk of questions. Now what's happened, of course, is increasingly, starting in the 80s, what you saw are a couple things. There was an agreement among scholars, among lawyers and practitioners, et cetera, that constitutional interpretation is not mechanical. You don't lay the Constitution next to the case before you and bingo, you know the result. That was thought of for kind of a long time. A famous judge from the Seventh Circuit who just retired wrote a famous article about this, and said, what, am I a potted plant? Of course it's not kind of mechanical. So what you saw is as that change occurred, you saw confirmation hearings start to become politicized in terms of ideology. And what that did is it brought a new vocabulary into confirmation hearings. The vocabulary of approaches to constitutional interpretation. Senators wouldn't ask directly if a judicial nominee is a liberal or conservative. That would be not right, because they're talking about law in the form of the Constitution. But the underlying assumption was that if I ask about your approach to interpretation, I'll know whether you're a liberal or a conservative, and so I can get to the same point. The difficulty with that assumption is not always accurate by any means, either historically or today. First of all, the Constitution, as I said, is not self-interpreting, and you have human beings doing the interpretation. And what I want to do is talk about why we need to look at approaches to constitutional interpretation and the politics of it in a more nuanced way than senators do, and I hate to say even Justice Ginsburg did when she said, stop that nonsense. Several things. Why we have to look in a little more nuanced way. One, the crucial concepts are in very general terms. That makes it very complicated in terms of, certainly it can't be a mechanical approach. Second, what we see is that even if justices and judges are looking at one particular provision, there's still choices to be made. Which part of the wording, the text, do you want to emphasize? Which part do you want not to emphasize? And of course, what I'll talk about is that judges use different interpretive styles, even though they are ideologically alike. And justices who are ideologically opponents use the same interpretive style. And so we have to be a little more nuanced in kind of evaluating what's going on and thinking about the Supreme Court in the future and the justices on it. Because if we don't, there's going to be inevitable disappointment. People are going to be upset at how the justices decide. Oh, I thought he was a conservative. he used originalism. He shouldn't have decided this way, etc. And so I kind of want to talk about that a little more. And what I'm going to do, since time is limited, I'm going to talk about the three basic approaches that are talked about the most nowadays. I'm going to talk about the reasons that individuals think those approaches are the best. I'm going to talk about why critics think those approaches don't work. I'll tell you about the justices associated with those approaches. And then what I thought I would do is really demonstrate some of what I've already talked about. I'm going to do it in all three areas of approach. I've chosen predominantly one area. I'm going to use freedom of speech because people are really familiar with that. That's not hard. I'll talk a little bit about gun rights, a little bit about some other material as well. But so I think we'll get going from there. The first approach I want to talk about is originalism. Now, originalism is an approach that really started to gather momentum and really rise in kind of the legal and political lexicon in the early 1980s, particularly with Attorney General Ed Meese. Ed Meese and many people in the Reagan administration were upset with what they saw as the liberal rulings of the liberal Warren Court. And they wanted to be able to push back. And they were worried about how the Warren Court had ruled in criminal justice matters, in matters of equality and affirmative action, in matters of free speech, and all kinds of matters. And so the thinking was, the Warren Court was using something called the Living Constitution that I'll talk about briefly a little bit later. But I want to talk about originalism first, because that's when you really start to see the real rise of the politics of constitutional interpretation in the way I'm defining it. Now, what Meese suggested is that justices on the court should use what he called original intent. And with original intent, he meant something quite simple. Here's the question the justices should ask themselves. What did the framers want to do? What did the framers want to do? What was their intent? And Meese said, here's how you find intent. You look at founding documents. Obviously, you're going to look at the Constitution itself. But for intent, you need more than simply the words, the text. So you would look at the Federalist Papers. I'm sure many of you are familiar with those. You look at Madison's Notes of the Convention. You look at those really valuable founding texts. And the idea of this approach, original intent, is that the framers acted in a calculated manner. They were smart men that acted in a calculated manner. They knew what they were doing. And the other idea of this was, if you looked at original intent, you would eliminate justices reading their own value preferences into the Constitution. Because that's what Meese and many people in the Reagan administration argued, that the Warren Court justices read their own value preferences into the Constitution. So that's the way to kind of fix that problem. Now, critics, of which there were many, had a lot of arguments or a lot of questions about original intent. I'm only going to kind of mention a couple of them and go on a little bit so we have time to look at all the parts of this politics of constitutional interpretation. But three main criticisms that you saw a lot in debates and literature and a whole lot of areas are these. One, who are the framers? Are they just the people at the Constitutional Convention? Are they the people in all the state ratifying conventions? Who counts? Who counts? Second of all, okay, yes, the framers acted in calculating in a calculated manner. They knew what they were doing. And when you say that, you think about specific purposes to really deal with a specific issue. But there were a lot of compromises. Yes, they're rational in some way, but maybe not rational in any kind of deep philosophic political vision. Maybe they were rational to get the damn thing passed, if you will. And the third thing is that intent is interesting. A lot of people voting, just like the current Congress, people might vote for something for different reasons. So how do you figure out the intent? Now, what happened is one of the foremost critics of this original intent happened to be a Reagan nominee to the court. His name, Anton Scalia. He had trouble with a lot of the things that I just talked about. And so he said, okay, I believe in originalism, but let's not go to original intent. It's too hard. And he really popularized the idea of original meaning. Some people call it textualism. I personally don't like that word, textualism, because there are textualists that are not originalist as well. So I would stick with original meaning. Now, here's the question that originalists like Scalia ask. Instead of what did the framers want to do, Scalia originalists ask, what did the words mean to the people of the time in which they were written? What do the words in the Constitution mean to the people of the time, in which they were written? Look at the words, not outside material, not all kinds of things like that. Again, the idea was the same as original intent. You're going to eliminate the justices reading in their own values into it. Again, there were was obvious difficulty. Some critics said yes, but how do you know what these words meant to the people of the time in which they were written? The answer was, well, look back at the dictionaries of the time. But sometimes the dictionaries didn't have those kind of legal words in them. Like reasonable, probable cause, things like that. And the second thing the critics of Scalia's originalism talked about is that doesn't help with something really important. Wonder if two provisions of the Constitution clash. There's nothing in any text that says whether the First Amendment is more important than the Sixth Amendment, whether the Second Amendment is more important than the Eighth Amendment, nothing. So we're left in abeyance by that. So that's kind of originalism, if you will. Now, I promised you that I'd go a little bit deeper and show how originalism connects or doesn't connect to ideology. And I'll use Scalia, and I'll use free speech, so that you can see why I think that you ought to have a more nuanced look at the modern politics of interpretation. I have three or four examples that I'll give you. There are many more. I've tried to stick with one area for the most part. So these are cases in which Scalia was one of the majority vote, and it shows you what happens. These two cases are cases in which Scalia could not, if you will, please either conservatives or liberals at different points in his tenure on the court in terms of his vote, his decision, and whether people liked the opinion. The first one is a very early one. It's called Texas versus Johnson. It's in 1989, and interestingly enough, this particular case came out of the Republican convention in 1984 that would renominate Ronald Reagan. And there were lots of demonstrations by individuals that didn't like Ronald Reagan very much, including a Mr. Johnson, who stood on the steps of the convention center where this Republican convention was held and proceeded to burn an American flag. In Texas, there was a law on the books that banned the burning of the American flag. The case went up to the United States Supreme Court, and Justice Scalia, along with Justice Brennan, who wrote the opinion, and if you know nothing about Brennan, he is one of the original Warren Court liberals, and others as well, Marshall, Blackmun, and Kennedy, that I'll talk about later, said, no, Texas, you can't do that. Burning the American flag is speech. Well, you can only imagine, particularly given the context, that ideological supporters of Scalia are, what? What happened? Something happened. He disconnected from this. Now, later in time, he was a very important supporter of another case that's a big case in the kind of legal lexicon, Citizens United versus the FEC. If you don't know Citizens United, 2009, it is the one that prohibits restrictions on independent expenditures of corporations. Why? Scalia said, it's speech. Expenditures by corporations are speech. Now, of course, liberals who wanted to see, these restrictions are like, yeah, see, he really is, you know, an originalist, a conservative, see, forgetting a little bit, Texas versus Johnson. Now, I'm going to turn to another case so that you can see it's even more nuanced and a newer case, one you might not be that familiar with. It's called Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association. It is a 2011 case. What it involved is a California law that prevented minors from accessing very violent video games. It was really popular. You had people across the ideological spectrum in California go, yes, we don't want our young children having access to violent video games. The Entertainment Merchants Association said, no, it's freedom of speech. This is freedom of speech. Minors should be allowed access. Now, here's the interesting thing. You had a majority opinion and a very strong dissent. They were from two iconic conservative members of the court that both use originalism and the same kind of originalism. They found themselves on opposite sides. Scalia wrote the majority opinion. Scalia said, freedom of speech, as originally understood, meant no content restrictions. I may not like this, but it meant no content restrictions. This is a content restriction. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote the dissent. Thomas said, freedom of speech, as originally understood, did not include minors. So the First Amendment doesn't protect these merchants in the face of this California provision. Now, interestingly enough, scholars of the First Amendment will say they're both right. Each of those understandings is accurate. So originalism worked in that case in terms of the understanding, but there was a choice still to be made about which part of the understanding that justice gave priority, a value choice. Now, another and last example of a case before I move on. Again, it is a case with Justice Scalia. It is not a free speech case. This is a gun rights case. Again, I picked it because it's so famous. It's the DC versus Heller case in 2008 is the seminal case on gun rights. And what you had here is two people battling it out, again, who are originalists. This time, though, it wasn't Scalia and Thomas. The originalists were Scalia and John Paul Stevens. John Paul Stevens was appointed by Gerry Ford in the mid-70s. But by this time, John Paul Stevens had become one of the leading lights of the liberal bloc of the court. He also used originalism. Again, opposite sides. Now, just, I'm going to read the Second Amendment because what I say about the Second Amendment is important so that you can see what happens here. And I'm even reading comments, and you're going to think, what? But just wait. Here it is. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. Different conclusions, different emphasis, same approach to constitutional interpretation, originalism. Stevens and Scalia waged battle over the clauses and the commas in between the clauses and how it affected the meaning of the times. Scalia, of course, said it means there is an individual right to bear arms. Stevens said, no, you're not looking at the commas and how people at the time would look at those commas. It means a militia has the right to bear arms. Again, so a more nuanced approach, certainly to originalism is in order. And it's the last thing I want to say about originalism, and that'll allow me to move into living constitution or adaption. And again, I'm going to use Scalia himself. Scalia, in an interview, in a long interview by an interviewer for a magazine, and an interviewer for a magazine that was actually quite sympathetic to Scalia, asked Scalia about flogging. And asked Scalia if flogging was understood at the time not to be within the meaning of the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. And Scalia answered, yes. And the interviewer said, what about a state that has flogging now? Scalia, at first glance, thought otherwise, but after said, well, the Supreme Court would not let it stand, clearly intimating that that included him. He then said, well, I guess I'm a faint-hearted originalist. This is from the person that popularized originalism, the hero of originalism, the person that everybody asked Gorsuch if he was alike. And so that faint-hearted originalist comment really kind of gathered storm in terms of criticism of originalism. And you started to see people again talk about the living constitution, about adaption, which was, as I said, the approach that was used by the Warren Court, only the Warren Court didn't really speak of it so much in these terms. In other words, all the living constitution is, all adaption is that you must interpret the constitution based on changing conditions and lessons of experience. You must interpret the Constitution based on changing conditions and lessons of experience. And critics of originalism kept pointing to Scalia. That's what Scalia's doing. He's saying he wouldn't let, and the court wouldn't let flogging stand based on lessons of experience. Just like we're sure that Scalia would not say that the individual right to bear arms includes individuals having atomic bombs if that wasn't possible, or drones with arms, or bazookas on tanks, etc. That you can't do that. And what you see, the place where you see living constitution used still today a lot, one of the two areas is exactly the area of the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. Many of the decisions regarding the death penalty as of late, death penalty as to minors, death penalty as to the mentally challenged, have used the adaptive approach, talking about the evolution of experience that it has been undergone in civilization. Now, currently on the court, if you want to know who is the icon of kind of the living constitution, the adaptive approach, is Scalia's best friend, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She openly talks about how there needs to be an adaptive approach, With Ruth Bader Ginsburg are also Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. Stephen Breyer, I've put in the general box of adaptive approach. If you read Stephen Breyer's writings, he writes about his own philosophy of interpreting the Constitution called active liberty, in which he believes liberties should be interpreted in a way that advances democracy. But his vision of that is an adaptive vision. So even if it's a little bit different, it still broadly falls in that category. Now, criticisms of this. Beyond, obviously, we saw earlier ones with originalism is, okay, changing conditions are maybe obvious. We know there are changes in technology. The internet that the framers wouldn't have seen, planes, space travel, all kinds of things. But it's this lessons of experience. How do you use lessons of experience in an adaptive approach in a way that doesn't have justices implanting their own value systems in the Constitution? The answer from individuals that like the adaptive approach are generally twofold. One, what is called polling jurisdictions. Look at what states do. In other words, if you are looking at the death penalty on a federal level, look and see how many states have the death penalty. If a lot of states have abandoned it, that may be a lesson of experience. That may be that maybe the death penalty is something that should now be considered cruel and unusual punishment. Obviously, that's not the case. Now, polling jurisdictions has not just been something internally into the United States. It's been something that some justices have said, and also we can look internationally at what other states, meaning countries, do in the death penalty. Now that wigged Scalia out completely. You know, this is the American Constitution. What are we doing? The response was, it's a human right. Human rights are human rights. They're recognized by many constitutions in many places. That's one answer to lessons of experience. How do you do it in a way where it's not simply the value judgments of the justices? The second way, I guess I would suggest, is a way that was talked about by Elena Kagan at her confirmation hearing. She was the last justice confirmed that was an Obama justice, so you can imagine she also received a lot of questions on her approach to the Constitution and a lot of them on originalism. And Kagan answered to a particular senator, well, we're all originalist, Senator. To which the senator was, what? Because Kagan, he didn't think of Kagan certainly as a conservative. And he said, you know, when you use an adaptive approach, you just don't start from scratch. You know, an adaptive interpretation has to be reconciled with the language and the purpose of the framers in adaption. And doing that will prevent the justices from simply placing their own value system on the Constitution. That's how Kagan responded to that. Now, what I would like to suggest is, like the conservatives on the court that I talked about in terms of Thomas and Scalia, their counterparts, the liberals on the court that believe in adaption, don't always agree with the outcome. And again, I wanted to use a free speech case. So I'm using one called Sorrell versus IMS Health. It's not a very famous case, but it'll really show you what happens. In this case, you have Sotomayor. Sotomayor votes with Scalia, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, see? And on the other side, you have Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan. So you have all the other adaptionists on the other side. What this case was about was a commercial speech case. In particular, there was a Vermont statute. It's a prescription statute. It had to do with confidentiality. And this law forbade companies from disclosing physician prescribing data for selling purposes or marketing purposes. Sotomayor and her colleagues in the majority said, yeah, that violates freedom of speech. Now, she uses an adaptive approach that even if the framers believed freedom of speech to cover political speech, that commercial speech gives individuals information. And because of that, that's important in a free society to have that kind of information, especially the one that runs on private enterprise, capital, etc. And that's been the case since the 1970s, of course extended here. Her colleagues with the Living Constitution approach, the Ginsburg, Breyer, Kagan team, said, no. We believe that there's something called the right to privacy. It's not literally in the words of the Constitution, but it's there. And to have data mining companies give away private health information about things so personal to an individual, no, that violates the notion of autonomy that is part of the right of privacy. So you can see kind of, again, that you cannot use Living Constitution to equal liberal result or conservative result. Now, I'll briefly, I'm looking at the clock, talk about the last kind of area, last approach to constitutional interpretation. And I notice I use the word kind of, because that's what it is, kind of an approach. It is not an overarching philosophy. There are three people on the court that are considered pragmatist. Justice Kennedy, who many of you might know, seems to be the person who's got all the power on the court because he votes, you know, with the liberals sometimes and the conservatives other times. Roberts, the Chief Justice of the court, and Sam Alito. So that you kind of know. Now, remember, it's not an overarching approach. But every one of these justices, when they were asked at their confirmation hearings about originalism, all rejected it. No, I'm not an originalist, which might shock you when you're thinking of Roberts, but certainly Alito, because people often used to talk about Scalito, that Scalito and Alito were so exactly alike when it came to conservatism. Kennedy is, you know, often called the Sphinx of Sacramento. That's where he's from, because no one can figure out how he's going to vote. But let's talk about this pragmatism. If not an overarching philosophy, what does it mean? And here's what I would say. When I was trying to boil it down for an audience that would make it kind of straightforward, these are the things that I think you think of when you think of a pragmatist on the court. One, pragmatists usually place a lot of emphasis on precedent, stare decisis, following past decisions. Two, pragmatists are often believers in judicial restraint. In other words, that the court should exercise its judicial review power and not strike down legislation very often. That the court should have not a minor role in politics, but not a large role in politics. And the third part of this pragmatist factor, and it depends upon which pragmatist, is that sometimes it's not enough to look at history, precedent, text, purpose, that sometimes you need to look at other scholarship to determine how to apply the Constitution. And I'll give you examples of all three. First, I'm going to go to Kennedy, the Sphinx of Sacramento, because he is that swing justice. Everybody's like, when is Kennedy going to retire? What difference will it make on the court? All kinds of things. A couple cases. The first case I want to show about pragmatism with Kennedy is a case called Lee versus Weitzman. It's a 1992 case. And it involved a case where a school was sponsoring a cleric's, sponsored a cleric, and that cleric was supposed to conduct a non-denominational prayer at graduation. And Kennedy wrote the opinion for the court. And interestingly enough, we now know that in the conference, which is secret, that he originally voted on the other side. But he's the pragmatist. So he's thinking about past precedent. He tends to be a restrainist, but not always. We'll talk about that a little bit. But he also thinks about, okay, the purpose, the text. And he was thinking about separation of powers, the history. What the framers were thinking about was coercion. Coercion to go to a particular church, to be a member of a particular faith, either coercion by imprisonment or coercion by a tax. But Kennedy wanted to think more deeply about that, and he thought about modern day experiences, and he looked at psychological studies, social science literature about coercion. And he determined that even if an individual didn't have to stand, didn't have to participate in this non-denominational prayer, that psychologists believed it to be coercive. Now, Scalia, the originalist, you can imagine, lost it. Scalia's coercion is either imprisonment or a tax. But you can see that pragmatist in Kennedy. The second thing, a very famous case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, also 1992. It is the case that upheld the basis of Roe versus Wade. The right to privacy includes a right to an abortion. Again, if you read the Kennedy-O'Connor-Souter decision, you're going to see that it's deeply invested in the idea of following precedent. Following precedent. That is a form of restraint, too. Now, Justice Scalia, usually people think of restraintists as conservatives. But Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, Justice Roberts have all talked, especially Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, have all talked about wanting to overturn Roe versus Wade, Planned Parenthood, which is an activist position. So again, these don't always fit in a nice, neat little box. Now, Roberts, I'll speak about Roberts in a moment, and also a little bit about Alito at the same time with the next case, and then sum up a little bit, and maybe there's some questions or comments, because I've had to kind of fly through this and give you little tastes. I want to talk about, of course, the National Federation of Independent Business versus the Sebelius case. If you don't know what that is the Affordable Health Care Act. That's Obamacare, when the Supreme Court upheld the challenges to Obamacare. Now, what happened, of course, is Roberts voted in the majority, much to the dismay of Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Kennedy. Kennedy, he's a restrainist in some ways, so he's not so likely to always, you know, but in this case, what's going on? He's on the other side. He's being active. He's overturning it in some method. Roberts was one in a majority that said Obamacare was constitutional under Congress's taxing and spending power. Now, it's pretty clear when you look at Roberts. Remember I said it's precedent, it's judicial restraint. There was judicial restraint. But Kennedy, remember I said he looks at outside sources to illuminate text. Roberts, because he is the Chief Justice, pays attention to court credibility and legitimacy in a way that the other justices don't. It's occurred in at other times with other chief justices, etc. And you see that pragmatic, if you will, kind of attitude. Now, you'll notice that Alito, who more than anybody else espouses the idea that he believes the court should have a minor role in the American political system, was willing to be active and overturn Obamacare, if you will. So again, it supports the idea that approach and ideology and justice, you cannot have a simplistic evaluation of what's going on. You have to look more deeply. The politics of constitutional interpretation is one of subtlety. You cannot use shorthand. An approach equals an ideology. You do that at your peril, whether you're a citizen, a senator, an interest group, etc. That evaluation can lead you astray. You know, when I think of the politics of constitutional interpretation, I think of it as the politics of applied meaning. In circumstances that are quite different from the framers, no matter if you're an originalist or a living constitutionalist or a pragmatist, you know, justices don't write on clean slates either. There's all kinds of precedent. The Constitution, by its nature, invites debate. By its text, by its circumstances, by the role the court has undertaken. There's a scholar whose wording I liked that I wish I had thought of. I haven't, but I'm going to use it because I think it kind of sums constitutional interpretation and the politics of it better than anything. He said, "The Constitution is not a noun, it's a verb." Thank you so much. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to ask. Yeah. Oh, Mike, that's right, Mike.
Hi, that was a great talk. I really enjoyed it. And here's my question. When you were talking about pragmatism, I was wondering whether you might say that the pragmatists often look to facts, the facts of a case more than others do, as opposed to looking just at the law, looking at the unique facts of a case, and that the pragmatists might do that because they're sort of less enamored of any one sort of theory or whatever.
Overall approach?
Yeah, overall approach. So my question is, Is there some, is that true to any degree, or really is the facts versus law distinction something that's really quite separate from the different approaches that you've been talking about?
Yes, I think I understand completely why you think pragmatists might pay attention to facts in a way that those with those overarching approaches don't. And I would say it's a distinction, but not a huge difference. And the example I can think of is in that DC versus Heller case, when both Scalia and Stevens were looking at historical facts. They were choosing to look at different historical facts in terms of original understanding and meaning. I do think that is somewhat true, though. It is somewhat true.
I'm curious as to your opinion about how much the average voter should pay attention to the Constitution, or not to the Constitution, but to the Supreme Court. Constitution also.
More than voters do. Whenever polling is done, you know, very few voters can name one or even two justices of the court. There was a recent poll in which I believe 30 or more percent suggested Thurgood Marshall was on the Supreme Court. Granted, he was a Supreme Court justice, but it's been a long time. Anyway, because we are, by its nature, a country that is deeply engaged in liberal legalism. And the Constitution is both a legal and a political document, as de Tocqueville way back when noted, and I said, you know, so many of the political questions become legal ones, and it matters. It matters, and why even more so today than before. It used to be when newsrooms had more, where they were flush with more cash, et cetera, you had individuals, even on the main channels, that CBS, ABC, Fox came a little later, NBC, that the individuals covering the court, the reporters, had a legal background or a background in political science in which they could really talk about the court and really explain it a little bit more. I've seen so many times lately where reporters that don't have any background will come out and say, the court has decided X. And it's because they're flipping through an opinion, they don't really understand it, and in fact, sometimes opinion is what is called a plurality, which I didn't touch, but a plurality is where a majority of justices vote for a side, but you can't even get a majority to decide on the same reason. When that happens, it's not precedent. Only who is ever involved, the party, the winning party's happy. Okay, but it doesn't do anything for the future. And I've seen it, and I thought, oh, my gosh. And it's been in important areas of freedom of speech, reproductive rights, a whole range of things. And so I think for many reasons, it's really incumbent, you know, on citizens. It's one of the co-equal branches of government, you know? So, yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
Washington State and, Colorado have both legalized marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government says, not so fast. Now, at the same time, California is now considering to become a sanctuary state and take it up to the California vote for that. Mm-hmm. Now, to go back to 1832, South Carolina, yeah, I'm going right back. 1832, South Carolina tried to start a doctrine of nullification,
yes,
in which they felt that if it was constitutional or not, then we're not going to follow it.
Right.
And President Jackson was very much against that and said, you know, that's against everything that we have in the Constitution. That being the case, I don't think it's, you know, I'm still a, you know, youngling in law, not even a Padawan yet. But
A newbie. A somewhat newbie.
So are the courts going to consider looking at these separate laws of nullification is what essentially what these are. Are they going to take a look at that and make a determination whether or not that's the way they're going to go?
Let me just say, first of all, that you don't have to go way back in the 1800s to see nullification. The 1950s and Brown versus the Board of Education, you saw many governors stand in front of schoolhouse doors saying, no Supreme Court is ever going to tell me what to do as governor. And more recently, Roy Moore, who was a justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, and was essentially kicked off the court because he said the Supreme Court of the United States isn't going to tell me how to read the religion clauses. That's a continuing controversy. Every member of the Supreme Court is going to say they're institutionalists. So however they agree or disagree on an issue, they're going to say, wait a minute. We're the branch that is the final interpreter of the Constitution. Thank you very much. What you may see, though, is interesting differences in what happens with that. Justice Roberts, for instance, and Justice Thomas read federalism much differently than Scalia read federalism, for instance, or Ginsburg reads federalism. They're about as states' rightist as you can get. And that may play out in how much room someone like a Thomas would give, you know, the states, for instance, in having laws that allow for medical and recreational marijuana, for that matter, like Colorado. So it will be on another playing field. Other questions or comments or anything? We good?
Let's give Georgia a round of applause, please.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Georgia. I also want to thank College TV for recording this and make it available to people. I want to thank the Honor Center, of course, for always letting us use their space. I want to thank you for coming out and wish you a good day.